So far as I could tell, you slept soundly in your room on the upper floor of the guest house, outside the gates of the fortress in Vastai, until you were awakened by a furious pounding on your door. The moment the first knock sounded, you were on your feet, reaching for your knife, cloak cast aside. You stared wide-eyed at the door and then shouted, "Who is it? What do you want?" The pounding stopped.
"Aiolo."
Did you recognize the voice? Or had you heard it too few times yet to know who it was?
"Aiolo, wake up, child. I need to speak to you."
You hesitated a moment, sheathed your knife, pulled your cloak around you, and opened the door to find Mother Jejume.
I'm awake, Mother,
you said.
"You need to talk to Mawat."
"Excuse me, Mother,"
you replied.
"I don't understand."
"He listens to you, doesn't he? You said that he doesn't sulk in the field, and he brought you here with him and no one else. You must know how to talk to him."
I still don't understand, Mother,"
you said, polite but clearly confused. Your heart must still have been pounding from the sudden noise moments before.
"Why is it suddenly urgent that you come out of his room?"
"Oh, he has come out of his room,"
exclaimed Jejume.
"That's not the problem. He was always going to come out sometime, he always does. The problem is..."
She lowered her voice.
"What he's doing now is come out."
I still don't understand you, Mother,"
you admitted. "Surely the Lord Mawat will send for me if he needs me."
"I am sending for you,"
Jejume snapped.
"Go down into the square and talk to Mawat. Tell him he's being ridiculous and the least won't put up with his foolishness for long. Tell him whatever it is you usually tell him to stop him sulking like this."
You appeared to think about this for a few moments. "Where is the Lord Mawat?" Jejume closed her eyes and took a long, frustrated breath.
"I've just told you where he is. He's in the square outside in front of the fortress gate."
And then, sardonically,
"You can't miss him."
You said, with a small bow,
"I'll be downstairs in a moment."
Jejume looked, at first, as though that was not enough for her, as though she would argue. But she said,
"Good. Thank you."
And left. When you went downstairs and out into the square, you found the sun just barely risen over the rooftops to the east. A small crowd had gathered in front of the guesthouse door, the Julans among them, and presumably their snake. And you pushed your way through to find that people had gathered all around the edges of the square to stare at Mawat, sitting naked on the ground. Although Jejume had told you that Mawat was sitting in front of the fortress gate, this wasn't precisely true. He was, in actual fact, sitting in the middle of the square. The object of this sort of action, as I understand it, being not to block or otherwise hinder traffic in and out of a place, but rather to be sure everyone who goes through that gate sees one and knows what one's presence means. You walked up to him.
"My lord,"
you said.
"Good morning. Mother Jejume asked me to speak to you."
"What did Mother Jejume wish you to say?"
Mawat asked, not looking at you but staring blankly ahead. The morning air was chill and his skin was pricked with goosebumps.
"She said to tell you that you're being ridiculous and that..."
"Forgive me, my lord, I only report her words.
That the least won't put up with your foolishness for long, and she bade me say whatever I generally say to you to stop you sulking in the field."
"You are a faithful messenger,"
Mawat said, with a trace of bitterness.
"I do my best, my lord."
"I know you do."
Mawat's voice was gentler now, though there was no change in the expression on his face.
"My lord, Mother Zhuzhume is right. Your uncle can't tolerate this for long.
How generous of her to warn me.
The bitterness was back in his voice.
You'd better go back in and have your breakfast. I'm sure you'll be extra popular today.
My lord, you said, and went back to the lodging house. You made your morning prayers, and took your morning's bread and beer, and went to sit at one of the polished wooden tables, pulled out again now it was day and everyone awake. As you had the day before, you chose a seat from which you could easily see the door to the outside, the kitchen entrance and the stairs, and you sat with your back to the wall. You ate in silence. A few people came back in from the square outside and sat down to their own meals, casting sidelong glances at you, speaking quietly to each other. One of the Julans came in then, the one who had spoken to you yesterday.
Good morning,
the Julan said, walking up to where you sat. Everyone else in the room tried hard not to look as though they were staring at you both, or straining to hear what either of you might say.
Good morning,
you replied, polite but not warm. The Julan sat across from you, and the snake peeked out from the collar of his tunic, and then withdrew again.
I am not called myself before. I am Dupeju.
You did not reply, only took another bite of bread.
How are you called?
You chewed, deliberately, swallowed, took a swig of beer.
Aiolo,
you said finally.
Aiolo,
Dupeju said with a smile.
Aiolo, assistant to the Prince Mawat.
That's not a word in Iridani, you said. Prince is a Taufeng.
Ah, you are still el practice Iridani. Thank you, Aiolo.
Don't mention it. You took another bite of bread.
What is the good name, then?
The lease's heir. Dupeju leaned his elbows on the dark wood of the table.
The lease is heir Mawat. It does a strange thing. Our guide tells that this is force the king. King is also a tell thing.
Yes, you said shortly.
The lease. This is force the lease to do a public thing? Is this yes? What is the lease's heir wish?
You'd have to ask him.
But I am not known him,
explained Dupeju, in apparent dismay.
I am talk to you. And you are talk to the lease's heir soon past. Tell me, friend Aiolo, why is the lease's heir sit naked in the square? It is a complaining, yes, but complain what?
As I said, you'd have to ask him.
I am here, friend Aiolo, that something is wrong. That the king, no, you say the lease, yes, that the old lease is not have a... What do you say when someone dies?
A funeral, you supplied.
A funeral. The old lease is not have a funeral. There is a new lease. I know it is so. I am in Vastai for days and days, and the lease is not see us. Now the lease is see us once. And this man, who is the lease, is not the lease before.
You know this, you suggested, because you had met with the Lord Hebal before, and he was not the lease at that time.
Just the so,
Dupeju agreed.
I am met the Lord Hebal, the brother of the lease. I am hope he can tell the lease. You should see the Jolans. And I am think it work, and we are go in to see the lease, and the lease is Ebal.
You did not reply to this.
The Lord Mawat, is the Lys's heir at that time. But he is not Lys now. Still, he is Lys's heir. Is that friend Diolo? Why the Lord Mawat is sit on the ground outside? What is he expect happen from this?
Were you surprised that Hebal was Lys then? You asked, almost managing to sound innocently curious.
That might be a word, replied Yupezu. It is a word, assuredly. We are surprised, Dupeju agreed. We are not here the Lys is died, only that the Lys is... See us. It is very strange. And now the heir is come to Vastai and expect of the Lys is die soon, but already is a new Lys. And there is no funeral for the old Lys, and I am think everyone is not want to talk about that.
You finished the last of your bread, washed it down with the last swallows of your beer. I don't want to talk about it either.
Your lord is make everyone talk about it,
Dupeju pointed out.
I am think even you he wish to talk about it. A thing is strange about this new Lys. Is there not a promise with the raven of Iriden? The Lys may do as he likes until the god's bird dies, and then the Lys must die. We are here of it. It is not a thing that happens in a secret. The Tower of Vastai wears black. All of Iriden is at the funeral. Our guides say you carry the king's body in the street when he is dead, and the heir walks along, and everyone makes offerings and a feast. But there is no funeral, no body in the street, no feast, and still there is a new Lys, and is not Mawat. I am think something is happened that is strange. But why is the raven of Iriden do nothing?
Ask the raven of Iriden. You said,
ah, we are try. The raven of Iriden will not speak to us. But I am think the Lys's heir, Mawat, is treated badly in this. And I am think he agrees. And he wish to change this. He is naked outside, and everyone must see what is happen. Everyone must ask, why is this? And the least Hebal must answer or seem wrong. Yes?
Tell me, you said, is there one of you missing?
What?
Dupeju seemed puzzled by your question. Where is the man who interpreted for you the other day?
He is gone away,
acknowledged Dupezu.
He is afraid, dear. We are wait so long, and he will not stay. He is safer away.
He took his elbows off the table and leaned back.
We are trying to pray to the raven and offer gifts direct, but the raven is not answer, and this is a question for Prince Mawat as well. Why does the raven nothing? Why is the heir must sit naked before the fortress gates to complain of this wrong, to tell the people to make Lys Ebal to deal with his complaint? Why is not complained to the raven himself? Where is the god of Iriden?
Wherever he wishes to be, I suppose, you said.
Is it not strange,
observed Dupeju,
that he is not here now, and I am think he might be needed.
From under his collar, the snake's tongue flickered out and then back. No other sign of the snake itself, but a bulge under the fabric of his tunic.
Excuse me,
you said, rising. I have business to attend to. And without waiting for an answer, you left. Mawat still sat in the middle of the square. People still stood around the edges, but fewer than before. Others walked through apparently on ordinary business, some staring at Mawat as they passed, some affecting to ignore him. He still stared ahead, and Tikaz stood beside him.
I'm impressed, she was saying as you came up.
You're going to be the only person I know who dies of cold and gets sunburned in very delicate areas at the same time.
Mawat didn't answer her.
Whatever do you think you're doing?
What does it look like I'm doing?
Though he spoke to her, he still did not look at her.
Why are you here?
My father told me to tell you I'd sleep with you if you'd stop this nonsense.
I see no nonsense, Mawat said. If this were nonsense, my uncle would not have sent his chief counsellor to stop me, nor, for that matter, would the Mother of the Silent have tried to send Ayolo to dissuade me.
Tikaz turned to look at you. It's you again, then, is it?
Good morning, lady,
you said.
Without answering you, she turned back to Mawat, said in an even quieter voice than she had been using. I know what you're doing. Everyone knows what you're doing, but it won't do any good. Hibal is seated on the bench, and there's no changing that.
My father never fled, said Mawat. The hint of a shiver in his voice, likely the cold. My father never fled, and his brother sits on the bench, as though he belongs there, and no one says or does anything about it. Well, I will do something about it.
No one wants to think about it, Tikaz replied angrily. No one wants to think about what the raven will do if the lease isn't paid as promised. Everyone just wants things to go forward as they always have. There isn't anyone in Vastai who will thank you for making it impossible not to ask those questions.
We've known each other since we were small, replied Mawat. I'd think you'd understand me by now.
Oh, I understand you.
Tikaz was clearly angry, but still keeping her voice hushed.
Everything's fine until you get angry, and then it's all about you being angry. Don't you know sometimes you need to stop and wait? Sometimes you need to think before you jump into something. You expected to take the bench. Hibal took it instead, with the support of the directions and the silent, so you can't just go charging in.
And in the meantime, began Mawat.
And in the meantime, Hibal thinks he's won. Well, who cares what he thinks? Attend to what you think. You're still heir. You'll still be lease when Hibal pays. Why are you in such a hurry to pay yourself?
The lease is paid, insisted Mawat. My father never fled, and he'll have found a way to pay what he owes, no matter what Hibal did to stop him. And if Hibal truly believes the lease is unpaid, he should pay it now, himself. Loudly enough for a bystander to hear, and put a hand to her mouth and hurry away. If the guards at the fortress gate heard, they did not show any sign of it.
Maybe he means to, you suggested. Maybe he's only stepped up so he can make the payment in the next few weeks in place of his brother.
Tikaz rolled her eyes.
Who? Him?
If he meant to, he would have said so, Mawat pointed out. If he meant to pay this time, the flags would be flying from the tower and preparations would be underway. Instead, he's trying to pretend like nothing has happened, and the directions and the silent are going along with it. Why?
Why indeed?
Tikaz folded her arms.
You might want to ask that question before you do anything drastic. More drastic than what you already have done. And honestly, I'm not sure what that would be.
I will make everyone ask the question, replied Mawat. I will make Hibal answer it.
If you don't die of cold overnight, said Tikaz.
Mawat shrugged. The sun had risen further over the rooftops and warmed the stones around him. And Mawat himself, just a bit. Ayolo will bring me a blanket when the sun goes down.
Yes, my lord,
you said.
Vastai is full of people, and so, of course, it is also full of drama and interest, if, that is, you are interested in humans.
I have been interested in humans since I learned to speak with them, though I did not realize that until somewhat recently. But since I realized it, I have wondered why that might be. Was it because they had fed me? Was it because, now that I was able to speak to them, they seemed extra worthy of my attention, as though I had finally found another being in some way like myself and was no longer so alone? Or was it perhaps that their speaking to me, taking so much time to teach me to understand and speak in my own turn, made them so unusual in my experience? It may be. Even after I learned to speak, the Kalouet were not with me all the time, and so I still passed most of my days alone except for birds and the occasional fox or hare. These days I am always surrounded by people, and though for the most part I cannot speak to them, nor they to me, I still find them interesting. The Tower of Vastai, the fortress, the town surrounding it, provide a surfeit of activity and conversation, of triumphs and defeats. I watch and listen and learn, and of course I have good reason to pay close attention to certain people. The Raven's Lease, for instance, whoever that may be, and his heir. People whose small dramas will affect nearly everyone in Vastai, if not Iriden, and will potentially affect me quite directly. And so I do not wonder why I pay such close attention to them. But you. I cannot explain why I find myself so fascinated by you, why I feel the need to tell you these things, even though I strongly suspect you cannot understand me, perhaps cannot even hear me. You came riding out of the forest, stiff and uneasy in the saddle beside Mawat, who sat his horse as though he had been riding since he could walk, as indeed was the case. And at first, I noticed only Mawat. Of course I did. I knew that a messenger had been sent for him, and I knew what awaited him in the fortress, knew that even if Mawat had been the sort of person to take this situation with patience and quiet equanimity, the next few hours would be full of distress and anger. And Mawat had never been the sort of person to take any situation with patience or quiet equanimity. You? I did not recognize you. Perhaps you were a servant. But when I looked closer, heard you and Mawat speak, I realized you could not be merely a servant. For one thing, though you sat your horse like a farmer and sounded like one, your bearing, your weapons, and even your small bit of gold suggested that you were, in fact, a soldier. And for another, Mawat clearly trusted you. Had wanted, I suspect, to ride alone, knowing he rode toward his father's death, and the promise of his own, defined, fixed, and unignorable. But he did not ride alone. He rode with you. And furthermore spoke to you as though he did not resent your presence, as though you were his friend, or as close a thing to a friend as someone like Mawat can have. And why you? To judge by your manner and accent, you are the child of a reasonably prosperous farmer, and no doubt many such run away, hoping to find glory or wealth in battle, or else they find themselves on the battlefield through chance or conscription. They do not, as a rule, find themselves the confidant of the heir to the bench in Vastai. These days, the people closest to me are the ones I know the best. I have long understood in a vague and general way how human bodies are put together, how they work when they work, and some of the most obvious ways in which they would cease to work. But in recent years, I have watched more closely. I have seen the pull and slack of muscles, the trembling of exhaustion, the racing heart and laboured breath of pain and distress, wordless sobs in despairing throats, the dull, glassy downward gaze of a person who has lost all hope of any rest that is not the subtle and sudden stillness of death. I have heard anguished cries, alternately begging and cursing a god who seems not to hear. The chafe of bound wrists, turning bloody and blistered. I have seen these things, and thought about them, what they imply, what they mean. I don't know your thoughts or feelings, but I can guess. I can guess what it means that you stop and stare at Tikaz the way you do. What might be happening when Mawat speaks, and why you follow him. I might understand more if I were one of those gods who took another form. There were and are gods who find it useful or pleasant to inhabit animal bodies. This, the myriad informed me, can be done well and deftly, or it can be rough and careless, ultimately injuring or killing the subject. The more one understands about one's chosen vessel, the more successful such a possession will be. I suspect that in addition to individual taste and inclination, this is why so many gods in my experience seem to choose the same sort of form over and over. The myriad and her swarm of mosquitoes, for instance, or the raven of Iriden. The safest way to do it, or so I'm told, is also the most laborious, to lay claim to a creature in embryo, and so be present as it grows. It is entirely possible to enter a more or less full-grown body, but I am told this requires more power and skill and practice. This has never interested me. I was content to be a stone on a hillside, to watch and listen. I watch and listen still. I hear every word uttered in the fortress of Vastai and nearly all in the town. I can tell you, if you should wish to know, the number of rats in the fortress, and even how many fleas are carried by those rats. I knew when Mawat was born and his father before him. I have seen and heard the private moments of all who have lived within these walls, and I have had time to think about what I see and what I hear. I have learned a great deal. I can guess that at some point relatively recently, your shoulder was injured. You don't raise your left arm as often as I might expect you to, and when you do, you move only in particular ways. I can also see that you are, for the most part, good at concealing the most obvious of your reactions, though traces can still be seen. A catch of breath when something jars your shoulder. A tight, displeased quirk of your mouth when someone has angered you, the flash of fear across your face. I can see all of these things, can guess what they mean. I have very little else to do, and I have always watched and listened and pondered, and besides, the Raven Tower of Vastai is made of stone. When the Raven of Iriden spoke his authority over the strait, the effect on the gods of Ardvuskdia was immediate and dramatic, or so I am told. But it took months for anyone in the north to become concerned. After all, it did not matter to the Kalawet or their neighbours who it was who bought their narwhal tusks jadeite or carefully hunted white fox furs. There were more important concerns for all of us. For the various peoples of the far north, there was the urgent business of preparing for winter, lest it be the last they saw. And gods and humans both had their own relationships with each other to manage, their own claims to food and territory to sort out, their own feuds to prosecute. But over the centuries that I had sat alone in the ice, waiting for humans to return, those furs and tusks and stone had been steadily flowing southward in exchange for metal knife blades and swords, bronze cooking vessels, and fine painted pottery. And even I, who did not yet fully understand the new-to-me language of the Kalawet, sitting alone on my hillside, thinking my slow thoughts, even I could see that people dressed differently from those I had known formerly, and carried different tools. Coats were embroidered with glass beads, brilliant blues and greens and oranges, or bright-coloured thread. These had come through Ardvuskdia, an indication, in fact, of how very freely goods and people flowed from there to the north. And while the beads and the dyed threads were largely vanities, take them away and there would be new ways to decorate clothes, new styles, the knives and the cooking pots had made life a good deal easier and would be difficult to give up if the supply ever ceased. But why should that supply cease? Even when news of the dispute over the strait reached us, very few imagined that we would be affected. Whoever occupied the strait would doubtless want high-quality white fox fur and whale teeth, and there was no reason they would not continue to trade bright bits of glass and thread and knives and metal pans to get them. Why should Ard Vuskdir's local affairs matter so far away? For months, this seemed entirely reasonable. Every now and then I would hear news from Ard Vuskdir, attenuated almost to incomprehensibility by time and distance. The gods of Ard Vuskdir had struck back at the raven with a speech of their own, contradicting his. This, the raven had survived, despite the unlikelihood of his having enough power on his own to stand up to the gods assembled against him. Clearly he had allies who were helping him, and the gods of Ard Vuskdir accordingly called in more help from the surrounding area, small and middling gods with whom they had relationships and agreements. Still, the raven held out. As the words of the various gods pushed and pulled against each other, sailing through the strait became chancy for everyone. Ships left Ard Vuskdir's harbours, not for the open ocean, but back to the shoulder sea, to wait until the matter was resolved and travel safer. Some of those ships carried goods that now would not find their way into the hands of the northern peoples. Many of my fellow northern gods were concerned by this news. The gods who had been drawn into the struggle against Vastai had themselves relationships and agreements with gods farther away, who had agreements with other gods, and those with still others, in a web that reached all the way to my own hillside, and yet farther to the ice-rimmed Arctic Sea. Many southern associates of the Myriad sent word asking for her assistance, expressing their anxieties about the ultimate aim of the raven's ambitions, worried by the thought that he had far more power than anyone on the Ard Vuskdir side of the strait had ever suspected. But they were closer to Vastai than we were. In the end, we were sure, no matter who ruled Ard Vuskdir or Vastai, the traders would return to Ard Vuskdir and would want those furs and stones again. The winter came, and I was alone again on my hillside, watching the sky, the pleasant and satisfying rounds of the sun and the stars. At length, warmer weather brought the Kalawet back. Distraught. The conflict between Vastai and Ard Vuskdir showed no signs of resolution, and spring had come with barely any usable wood washing ashore in the places it should have. There were, it was true, a few stunted willows growing near my hillside, but not enough to support the needs of the Kalawet, and they had become used to trading for driftwood with the people who lived on the shore of the sea. But there would be none this year, or likely the next. You are, I think, an experienced soldier. If you have understood my story, you will doubtless have anticipated this turn of events. As the gods' stalemate over the strait stretched out, each side sent boats and soldiers against the other. Boats were nearly always built at least partially of wood, and the soldiers required bows, arrows, spears, swords and knives, all of which either had some wooden parts or were made and shaped with fire. Agreement or not, there was no wood to spare. Of course, the sooner the fight was over, the sooner the north could have its supply of wood again. And thus many of the gods and the humans of the far north began to seriously consider going to war. But not all. Not even every god concerned in the agreements that had brought wood so unfailingly and abundantly to northern shores. I myself had no pressing reason to go. At the worst, most of the humans who travelled to my hillside would withdraw farther south, unwilling to stray too far from places where trees might be found, and I would spend yet more decades alone, pondering things. I had made no promises regarding wood, or anything else. The Kalouet would come, or they would not come. Perhaps after a time, an entirely different people would visit me. Or if no people came at all, well, I would, I had to admit, miss them. But I had been fine without humans for so very, very long that I did not fear being without them again. I told the Myriad so. She gave a distressed, buzzing whine and said,
"Do you think you could stand apart? Do you think that because this place is so remote and rarely visited, that what happens elsewhere will not affect you?"
"I did not say so," I replied, "only that I expected that if these humans ceased to visit me, my life would be affected only in inconsequential ways."
"You may expect that," the Myriad said, "and you may be wrong."
"I am used to being alone." I had thought the Myriad was as well, but it may be I was mistaken.
"You may never be truly alone again," retorted the Myriad. "Perhaps you never were. This world we inhabit may seem large, full of unimaginably wide spaces, but from above one sees that it is a tiny island in the vastness of the wider universe. From where we are now, it may seem that Ardwuthia is too far away for its affairs to trouble us, and indeed, were we to set out now for the shore of the Shoulder Sea, you in a wagon, let us say, and myself riding and flying along, it would take us weeks or even months to reach it."
"So I have heard," I agreed.
"But," continued the Myriad, "were I to send a message, not go myself, you understand, but tell the right person that I wished my words or some news to be passed to a god in Ardwuthia, my words might travel from here to there in a matter of days."
"You yourself had a hand in making it so," I pointed out. "This business with the wood and the metal is, I suspect, largely of your own making. I believe that if not for that, events in Ardwuthia would have a good deal less effect on people here. And what do I care if wood or metal become scarce again? If the people who visit me find they cannot live here without those things, well, I am sure they must do whatever they think best. But I do not think it will trouble me. Things change. People come and go. I have always been sufficient for myself. Though, I had to admit, learning that there were others somewhat like me, with whom I could communicate, had added something pleasant and secure to my solitude.
"I like offerings," I admitted, "and prayers, but I have no great need of them that I can see."
"Let the people go where they think best. I believe I will be fine regardless."
"Perhaps you would," agreed the Myriad. "Other gods perhaps would not. So many have come to rely on humans to give them strength, and so many of us have become fond of the humans we have dealt with."
"Things change," I said. "Sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, but things always change. The ocean rises and falls, mountains thrust upward and are ground down again. The war between Ardwuthia and Vastai will end one way or another. The Raven of Iriden will be defeated, or he will be victorious. I have no doubt the specific outcome is of great concern to any number of people. I do not doubt that it matters to you, though I am convinced that its importance to you is entirely a matter of your having made it so yourself. But I am a stone on a hillside. I have been one since before Ardwuthia existed, before humans existed. Why should that change because one god rather than another lays claim to some water?" The Myriad was silent. Then at length she said,
"I
also was alone for a very long time. My first remembered sight of this world was of a distant, water-covered rock, and this did not change for so many of my long circuits. I did not even imagine the possibility that anyone, God or otherwise, might be found here. I did not wonder whether there was anyone else in the universe like me. I circuited merely around and around the sun and never sought to question or wonder or change my circumstances.
But let me tell you what I saw before I fell to earth. I saw two rocks collide so far away from this world that it might seem no more than a bright speck. And one of those rocks might have passed silently by this world on yet another long trip around the sun. And yet because of that collision, thousands of years ago, and so very far away, it tumbled to earth instead. And I thought to myself that if I knew enough, if I had enough pieces of that puzzle, I could see what will happen and when, across those unspeakable distances, across those many thousand of years, things change. You and I are both old enough to know it, but not all changes are inconsequential to us.
Perhaps not, I agreed. But consequential for us is not the same as bad for us. And even if it were, even bad conditions pass eventually.
We gods are usually long-lived enough to see that happen,
the myriad agreed. While we had been talking, the sun had gone down, and the tents of the people flashed now and then as the flaps were raised and lowered. People coming and going. Occasionally a reindeer grunted into the quiet darkness or took one or two clicking steps. The myriad landed atop me and sat silent a moment. The stars stood bright now in the dark sky. I have heard them compared to jewels, but they do not seem like jewels to me. Gemstones may come in many colours, bright or subtle, and can flash prettily enough. But a star's fire is its own. Excepting, of course, those few that are not stars but balls of rock like the one on which we live. And that, were they closer or larger, would appear to us as the moon does. But still I prefer those to gems. I do not know why. The flap of the tent of the priest of these people opened, firelight shining briefly out over the reindeer-cropped grass, and then darkness again as it closed. After a few moments, I heard the soft scrunching sound of someone coming slowly up the hillside path toward me.
"The question is not," said the myriad, "whether distant events will affect us. This is not truly a question. They can and have and will. Nor is the question how we will be affected. One can make any number of careful and informed guesses, but until events occur, any predictions are subject to error, to the extent that one's information or one's understanding may be incomplete."
"I dare say one's information and even understanding are bound to be incomplete," I remarked, "the universe being so wide and containing so much."
"Yes," agreed the myriad. "The relevant question here, it seems to me, is not any of those things. It is rather, do you care?"
The priest came before us then, set down the tiny lamp she carried, and prostrated herself. "Oh, strength and patience," she said, "stable and solid. On whom can we rely but you?" "She has not come to chat," I remarked to the myriad.
"Do priests generally come up here to chat with you?"
she asked. "This one does."
This priest had been born below my hillside, and since she was small, she had liked to come up to where I sat and talk to me. At first she had babbled nonsense syllables imitating the rise and fall of speech, or held up some leaf or rock she had found as if to show it to me.
As she grew older and her speech clear, she would sit down next to me and say whatever came into her head as we looked down at the camp. What she'd had for breakfast, what her mother had said the night before, what the clouds looked like that day. Or she would sit companionably silent. No one in the camp was surprised when she showed signs of becoming a priest, though the person to whom she went for instruction was, I am told, astonished to find that she could already read the tokens. She had taught herself, just watching and listening. And even after her training, she approached me as she always had, walking up the hill to sit and lean against me and talk, sometimes about the needs or requests of those in the camp, sometimes about inconsequential things.
"In a hopeless moment," continued the priest, who had not heard the myriad or me, "it is you we turn to. When all other gods fail us, you do not."
"Flattery," I said to the myriad,
"and she's following all the forms. She does not generally, not with me. She wants something delicate or difficult, I suppose."
The priest rose and bowed three times, saying again, "Oh, strength and patience." Then she knelt, and with her steel striker, that had come from the south, almost certainly through Ardvustia, she lit the tiny jadeite lamp. From her coat she pulled a bag, soft sealskin, lined with purple silk. The sealskin had come from a coast well north of my hillside, and had probably been bought with wood or bronze or even iron. The silk had come from south and west, a small fortune in itself.
"All stability of the hills,"
she said, still kneeling, and she took a handful of polished tokens from out of the bag, sorted through them until she found the several she searched for, and as she lay them down on the ground before her, said aloud,
"Strength and patience, foundation of the earth, surely you know that gods are quarrelling in the south, and what gods do among themselves is their own business, but this quarrel has deprived us of metal and glass. There is furthermore a shortage of wood. Even sticks cannot be found, for the trees they might have fallen from were cut down last year."
As she spoke, she laid down the corresponding tokens that would convey her meaning in that first language of mine, or some approximation of it, since she did not speak that language herself, could only roughly convey by their means what she more eloquently spoke aloud.
"But what little we now have, the Sokch of the coast could take from us. They raided a camp on the river, northeast of here. You know the people who stayed there, many of them visit us regularly every summer. The Sokch took everything, every scrap of wood, every fire striker, everything down to the last steel needle. They killed everyone in the camp. Only some girls out gathering eggs escaped and came to us this morning." "It seems to me," the priest continued, "that this has been caused by the same shortages I have just mentioned. They needed those same things we do, and because of the quarrel in the south, there were none to trade for or gift, and so they took them."
She took a few moments to clear the tokens before her and resort them in her hands.
"It seems to me,"
she continued then, laying tokens down in a fresh arrangement,
"that this will continue so long as matters in the south remain as they are."
"They might do as their forebears did," I suggested to the myriad, "and make needles of bone, and knives and spearheads of obsidian, and cooking vessels and hearths of soapstone." The priest hesitated. She might or might not have heard me. I was not trying to be heard by human ears.
"Bone needles break more easily," replied the myriad, "and moreover take time to make. Time that might be more profitably spent otherwise. The same for knives and spearheads. As for hearths and cooking vessels, an iron firebox does not crack under a flame's heat, nor an iron kettle, which is moreover a good deal lighter and easier to travel with. I never knew a dog or a bear to chew through a metal storage box,
In metal fish hooks, like metal needles, break far less often than their bone counterparts. Small wonder if, having gained these things, people do not wish to give them up. And even so, let us say they learn to make those things again. How long will that take? And in the meantime, they starve or murder and steal what they need from each other.
The priest shook her head, as though perhaps she had heard something, but had not understood it.
Oh, strength and patience, oh, foundation of the earth, this is my question.
Again she swept away the tokens before her, again began once more to lay them out slowly, each one carefully chosen.
When will this dispute in the south end and trade be restored?
Why do they ask me questions like that? I wondered to the myriad. I don't necessarily know the future any more than they do. How can I answer such questions at all usefully?
They believe you already have, replied the myriad. I have heard several times of people calling on you and receiving accurate and helpful answers, even though you were so distant, though no one had visited you for 100 years or more. Watch, and perhaps we shall see how it happens.
The priest swept all the tokens into the bag and shook it, then let one tumble out of the bag's mouth onto the ground. Then another, and another, until a haphazard row of them lay before her, gleaming faintly in the small lamplight.
Bear,
she read.
Towards a bear? Under twice? A question regarding grass that is above at some time, between, underneath, a white thing?
She sat back on her heels.
What does it mean?
She muttered. Has she not learned better than this? I asked.
I confess I was surprised. Always when I had spoken to her before, I had given clear answers that she had understood more or less easily. It seemed quite obvious to me that the assortment of tokens on the ground was no answer at all. I think she has been accustomed to such results many times in her life, said the myriad. Among the people who know how to use these tokens, you are reputed to answer infallibly, if nearly always, somewhat cryptically. The skill, they say, lies not only in reading the tokens, but understanding what you mean by them.
But I have always, to my knowledge, spoken quite plainly to this person, I argued. Somewhat foolishly, I admit, since the myriad was certainly telling the truth.
And the same with the priest before her.
The myriad said,
And when you choose not to speak, or when you cannot reply because you have not even heard the question, some arrangements of tokens is dealt out anyway. If the petitioner is in your presence, they may question you further and thus learn that an answer that is clearly nonsense is no answer at all. But people have been speaking to you this way for hundreds of years, speaking where you almost certainly would not have heard them, and they have read what they took to be your answers in the firm belief that you have indeed answered them. This is no doubt complicated by the change of language. I suspect that sometimes even your clearest replies must be puzzled through.
Do you really believe that I have been replying to them all this time, then? I asked, even when they are nowhere near me and cannot reasonably expect me to have heard them, let alone understood them.
Some of them?
No.
The priest looked up from her study of the tokens, frowning.
No, this is not an answer.
Ah, I said to the myriad. I was sure that after dealing with me for so long she must know better. I felt obscurely vindicated and relieved. Look. The priest swept the tokens again into the bag.
Was that an answer?
Tipped new ones out of the bag and read them.
It was not.
She looked up at me astonished.
But why? I don't answer that sort of question.
I told her by means of the tokens.
I thought you understood that. I don't foretell the future, except in the way that anyone does.
But you do,
insisted the priest. In her consternation, forgetting to lay out her words in the tokens.
I've seen it many times.
No, I replied, the tokens tumbling out of the bag to lie before her.
You have not.
She thought about that for a while, frowning.
But then,
she said at last,
have you heard anyone who speaks to you, who is not here before you?
Some, I replied.
After a fashion, I can feel when someone makes an offering, and sometimes I can feel a petition.
I did not say so, but suspected that I heard only those petitions that were enclosed in a prayer or explicitly connected to an offering.
Other gods can hear when people address them from far away,
the priest objected.
Some other gods, said the myriad, make an effort to do so. I do. This one does not.
Still kneeling, the priest bowed low.
Kind and merciful one,
she said.
I did not know you were here, or I would have made an offering.
I don't think I would know how to make such an effort, I said to the myriad. To the priest, the myriad said,
I am seen when I wish to be seen. Why are you here in the dark, devoted one?
The priest hesitated.
Surely you know, merciful one. But I suppose you want me to say it. Since the gods from the river camp arrived, there has been talk of revenge. I understand why, and even if I didn't, I won't be able to stop people from going north to kill what chokch they find. But what can the results of such an expedition possibly be except disastrous? Will the chokch not take revenge in their turn? And is it possible that gods will not involve themselves? We all have gods we favour who favour us. Will the drowned one or the mother of owls or the fox with red eyes not object to our killing and robbing their devotees, even if those same devotees killed our own people, even if we are merely reclaiming what they stole from us?
It may be as you say, replied the myriad, though I imagine some gods would say something like, you began this with your own theft and murder. Do not ask for me to approve it.
Some,
agreed the priest.
But perhaps they would not. Or perhaps, as time went on, they would be drawn in despite that.
I don't imagine the drowned one cares much about feuds on lands, I said to the myriad, and to the priest, by way of tokens.
I was under the impression that such matters as robbery and murder were brought to the annual assembly of the peoples. I have suggested that, said the priest. Most people don't want to wait that long. It's a year away. What if the tzokch mean to rob and murder us as well in the meantime? And if these people are desperate and cruel enough to kill all of the river camp, perhaps they will simply disregard the rulings of the assembly. That would be very bad. The assembly works because we all agree that it should. What happens when whole camps, whole peoples, say otherwise?
It's happened before, remarked the myriad. It was not pleasant for anyone involved.
Are the chokch involved, part of the assembly?
I asked the myriad.
I believe so, she replied. I don't think their withdrawal would necessarily break the assembly, but it would not be good. When the chokch joined, it was to the profit of nearly everyone involved. They gained a reliable source of metal and wood, and their neighbours gained a respite from their raids, for the most part.
The priest may or may not have heard the myriad speak.
And if things continue as they are in Ardvustia, where will we get metal or wood or glass except from each other? If the assembly declares the raters in the wrong, with what will they pay the fine? How will anyone pay a fine if we none of us have anything but what we need to live? And if that is how things are, if we all of us will have barely enough for ourselves, what then? The elders in the camp below are canny enough to ask these questions and have answered them by resolving to lay claim to what they can and defend it with blood, if necessary. Best, they say, to let all comers know that trifling with us is a dangerous act. But I don't see how this can lead to anything but disaster. If I can go back down to the camp and say, I have spoken to the strength and patience of the hill. This is a temporary thing, the shortage of goods that drove these Tzoktz to robbery. We have only to get through this year. Perhaps we can move our camp south and west of here, where another raid could not reach us quite so conveniently, and then bring our case to the winter assembly. If there are no southern traders there this year, there will be next. The robbers will be made to pay. The peace of the assembly of the peoples will not break. But we must be patient. If I can say that, perhaps no more lives will be lost.
I think you weren't sufficiently confident of my reply to ask in front of the elders, I said with tokens.
Your replies can be so difficult to understand sometimes, she said. They seem to mean one thing or nothing, until afterward when you see what was truly meant.
She knelt silent a moment.
And if you were going to say there was no end to this in the near future, then my attempts to prevent bloodshed would be undermined.
The night breeze blew chill over the hillside, and an owl screeched.
I don't know the answers to your questions,
I said with tokens.
I don't know when or how the dispute in Ardvustia might be resolved, nor do I know when or if trade with the south might resume, nor do I know the fate of the assembly of the peoples.
So, very clearly said.
There was despair and also puzzlement in the priest's voice.
There are gods who speak routinely in questions or vague generalities that might mean anything, said the myriad. I imagine it might be safest to do so, but the strength and patience of the hill has never, to my knowledge, made a habit of doing so.
But what about the time the foundation of the hills said things that seemed to be nonsense but turned out to be true?
Asked the priest.
I've seen it myself on many occasions.
The myriad said,
It's easy enough once events are clear to you. If you already believe some prediction must have been made true, to twist and turn the words until you find some way to make them so, however laboured, however tortuous. I've seen it myself, on many occasions.
I'll have to think about this,
said the priest. When she had gone, I said, Friend of mine, the lives of humans are brief in comparison to ours. Live as long as they might, they are here and then gone, as if it were in a flash. They all must die of some cause or another, and this assembly of peoples may have lasted several human lifetimes, and might or might not last several more. But there have been many such arrangements in the time I've known humans, and those all ended eventually, and were replaced by others, or by nothing. Why ought I care about this time, these humans in particular, when I know all are doomed to end no matter what, and shortly, from my point of view?
Tell me something, friend, replied the myriad,
Has anyone ever troubled the people who have camped below your hillside while they were here? Has great misfortune ever visited them while they were near you?"
"Not to my knowledge," I replied.
"Do you think that is by chance?" asked the myriad. "Because I do not, and nor do they."
I thought about that for several weeks. I knew that things changed. I had seen that change happen over hundreds, thousands, millions of years. I knew, or should I say I believed, that as this was just the nature of things, there was no point in attempting to prevent this change from happening, no point in becoming upset or unhappy about it. No change, I thought, had ever been enough to trouble me very much. But then, there were those times when I ought to have been covered in drifting sediment, in leaves or soil or ice, but I was not. If I had in truth merely accepted whatever change came to me, I would have been far, far under my hill rather than on it. I had done that, had for millennia continually prevented my own burial. The fact that I had not been conscious of doing it did not change the fact that I had done it. In all the long years I had been aware of things around me, aware of myself, I had learned that likely nothing was permanent. Had it ever occurred to me that I might not be permanent? It seemed to me that I had thought such a thing once or twice, but quickly turned to other subjects. Thinking of it now, I found the idea unappealing, unpleasant. I did not want to end, but it would seem to follow, from what I had observed of the world so far, that I would. I was, and am, cautious of how I might say such a thing, because I do not want to speak my own death. So I say only that it seems probable. At any rate, that being the case, why should I care if I lay under layers of rock the whole time? Why, as long as I'd been in this world already, should I care if my end came in another millennia or 100 of them? What sort of urgent business did I have in the world that I did not want to leave it? When I had spent my long time listening to fish or staring at the stars, what was the point? What had ever been the point in my constant unconscious effort to keep that view of the stars? None, except that I had wanted it. It had made things pleasant for me. What was the point when short-lived humans would die anyway, and others take their place? And humans, who by my reasoning had less ground than I to think anything they did might matter in any real way, did far more. They travelled. They changed the landscape in large and small ways. They put plans in motion that they knew they would not see completed, plans that would benefit not them but their children and their grandchildren. When I had kept myself clear of dirt and leaves and snow. Perhaps the length of one's life was not important, except in the way it is to so many living beings, desperate to avoid death. Perhaps long or short it mattered how one spent that time. Perhaps, though change was inevitable, the specifics of that change might be something one could manipulate. Perhaps one could not prevent change entirely, but one could try to guide events so that things would be better, if not for you, then for some future being or beings whose welfare mattered to you. Certainly most humans cared about the welfare of other humans, or specific other humans, children, parents, friends, fellow camp members, even theoretical children and grandchildren, people not yet born or even conceived, even sometimes, often, strangers. I had watched them do it. Dig and build to leave behind stores and shelters for whoever came next season, though they knew they themselves might not. Skin and tan and sew for some child not born, or some future spouse of a child too young yet to marry, or even think of it. And I had thought it just a peculiar thing that humans did, as so many animals have their particular habits and behaviours. I had not thought it was something I might do myself. Had I ever been asked to keep the camp safe from disaster? Oh, many times. Had I ever said that I would do so? never in such general terms, but it seemed I had done it anyway. Why? How different was I from the humans camped below me? Well, quite different in many ways. So much is obvious, but perhaps in some other ways, not so very different at all. While I was thinking about these things, the myriad did not visit me. She had gone elsewhere, I think. But one morning, as I watched the people go to and fro in the camp below me, fetching water, mending tent walls, gathering berries from along the stream bank, chatting or singing or just silent as the mood struck them, I heard the myriads whine above me.
"The Sokch are coming," she said.
The more I think about it, the odder it seems to me that the Iradeni have clashed so often with the Tell. It's not unusual for there to be difficulties between groups living near each other, of course, but in this case I might have thought the Tell and the Iradeni would have had all the forest between them. I might have thought that given the difficulty of traversing the forest before the God of the Silent allowed a road through the trees, contact between people from opposite sides of the forest would have been rare enough that they might have considered themselves different people, even spoken different languages, or at least very different versions of the same language. But there it is, as I'm sure you know very well. The people living on both sides of the forest consider themselves Iradeni, and not the same as the Tell. It is enough to suggest to me that the stories I've heard about the history and origins of Vastai, of Iraden and the Iradeni, are false in some way, or at least incomplete. As I believe I have already mentioned, when the raven took Iraden to war against the gods of Ardvusktia, the Tell were mostly no more than a nuisance. Granted, they were clearly a large enough nuisance that the Iradeni had asked the forest to help them with it, but the threat the Tell posed was mostly a matter of the occasional raid on some outlying farmstead. It was not, as it became some decades later, a question of massed and more or less organized forces. Usually less organized, the Tell, though they consider themselves a single related people, and though most of them profess loyalty to a king, have often done as each clan or even each individual sees fit. No doubt if the Tell had been much more trouble than they were, the raven would not have had the luxury of dedicating so much of his attention to taking control of the strait. But something has changed between then and now. Something that has made it desirable, or even urgent, for the Tell and the Ona and others to move toward the Shoulder Sea. Somehow the occasional raid became a sustained attempt to push the amorphous, ambiguous border of Iraden back toward the forest. I sometimes wonder if this had anything to do with the beginnings of the Julan expansion, with their conquering and holding other nearby cities, pushing their influence outward to lay claim to the fields, vineyards and orchards that fed Jula, to protect and control the routes that brought them luxuries and necessities. Jula is very far away, it's true, but not so far away that nothing from Jula can reach Iraden. And I can't help but notice that both the Tell and the Iradeni seem to have had more and easier access to Julan goods in the past few decades. Can't help but notice that Dupeju speaks Tell well enough that he likely learned it some time ago, and when he and the other Julans needed someone to translate Iradeni for them, they found someone among the Tell who could speak both Julan and Iradeni.